Welcome to the final episode of the Foreign Policy Association's virtual roundtable on U.S.-China relations. This is your host, Sarwar Kashmiri, and the sixth and concluding conversation in the series features Mr. Mark Chandler, Senior Vice President of Investor Services and Global Head of Currency Strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman, the New York Investment Bank. He is a prolific writer and speaker, and I caught up with him in his Wall Street offices. So, Mr. Chandler, in 2015, China had a 13% expansion of its service sector and just a 6% expansion of its manufacturing and construction sector. So, would you say that it is online now to make the changes in its economy that the United States and others have wanted it to make for a long time?
China's in the middle of this huge transition, and in many ways, what we really lack is a transparency, exactly what is happening. For example, this transition from the industrial sector to a service and consumption sector, it appears to be affected by prices as well. So, for example, we know that wholesale prices, producer prices, have been falling in China for more than 3 years. This is the price of capital equipment. And so, if you just think about the two sectors, one sector has falling prices, the industrial sector. Service sector has rising prices. And so it could be that part of the transition that China seems to be on is being affected by deflation in the goods sector and inflation in the service sector.
When there's a change like this, what does it signify to you as an economist? Do you think that this is necessarily something we need to be concerned about? There's a lot of talk about China just can't keep expanding the way it has. What do you think? Should one be concerned about this?
Well, I think that this is really one of the big challenges of our time is that, you know, for like 18 out of the last 20 centuries, China was the world's largest economy.
Right.
And then combination of imperialism, communism, has sort of led to the atrophy of the country. And since the late 70s, China has been sort of re-engaging. So I think making room at the table for China at huge scale is I would think, among the largest challenges that we as high-income countries or
right.
we as people of the world have to deal with.
There's been criticism since China set up its own infrastructure bank that China doesn't want to play by Western rules. But by the same token, you look at China being a member of the WTO, of the IMF, of the World Bank. So couldn't an equal case be made that China really does want to play with the rules of the game as they've been set up?
China is a two mind. One mind is that a status quo power. For example, like you say, joining the WTO. But on the other hand, it is also a revisionist power, because it's not happy with the international financial architecture. It is not content, like many other countries aren't, with a world in which one country seems to dominate.
And right.
That, of course, would be the U.S.
Right.
So on one hand, I say they have status quo power, working within institutions that already exist. And on the other hand, they want to create some parallel institutions. But I think that we'll find that over time, many of these parallel institutions can be co-opted or do not necessarily have to be outside the system. For example, the AIIB. Many people thought that it's a parallel institution, maybe a rival. But what we find out, for example, is that it will be giving its loan in U.S. dollars. When people subscribe to it, they'll be using U.S. dollars. I think that China wants to have it both ways. I think that is partly where tension arises. And what areas will China be a citizen of current institutions, and what places will it be challenging it?
On the long-term challenges, what are some of the long-term challenges you see to a smoothly running China-U.S. economic and foreign relations policies?
There's one big challenge that we could be distracted from by looking at sort of the short-term cyclical things, and that is, as China has industrialized, and especially its investment boom in the past decade or so, has created huge surplus capacity in over a dozen different sectors. And the question becomes, how is China going to deal with this excess capacity, partly this excess capacity, having steel mills, for example, all over China, is partly a source of employment. So if you begin nationalizing the industry, it's leading to unemployment in maybe rural parts of China. On the other hand, if China pursues a weak currency policy, the fear will be that China will take surplus and try to export it. And that would lead to a deflationary impulse around the world. It would lead to trade tensions.
Right.
And already we see what's happening. The steel is one of the places where the U.S. and European steel industries are well organized. They have taken action, investigative action, WTO action, to try to prevent China from dumping its surplus steel in the U.S. and Europe. What China appears to have been doing in the recent data, and this is, again, high-frequency data, but it looks like China has is exporting a bit less steel to the U.S. and Europe and dumping more of its steel, maybe dumping the strong word, but selling, exporting more of its steel to emerging market countries in Asia, including India, which is depressing their prices. And so the possible anti-dumping or protectionist action in the U.S. and Europe might not be hitting China directly as much as it hurts China's other trading partners,
right,
affecting China's surplus from the U.S. and Europe onto those other countries.
I'm going to switch to the topic of the so-called pivot to Asia. A lot of people are starting to think that the United States should not have emphasized the military aspects of the pivot as much as the economic and the opportunity aspects. Are you of that state of mind? Do you think we overly militarized that phrase, and that if we'd gone the economic commercial route, that it really would have done a lot of good?
I think that we're still in the early days of the pivot. Just like the last 200 years, we've depended on a northern Atlantic economic community.
Right.
But I think that there's a Pacific community that's being built, and it's not being built by politicians. I find that the state and the state's arms typically ratify and codify what businesses are already doing. That's how I would say NAFTA, for example, in the U.S. Trade was already going north-south long before NAFTA. NAFTA just codified it, created rules, created a resolution mechanism as well. And I think the same thing is being worked out in Asia, where a Pacific community is being built. More goods for the last quarter of a century or more, more goods have been going across the Pacific than the Atlantic. And I think that they're one belt, one road, the U.S. pivot to Asia, China developing both parallel institutions as well as using current institutions is the basic framework.
And so you don't then agree with the criticism some of the commentators in America make, which is, why is China going off and setting up all these parallel organizations, that it really ought to come up with the principles that have been established since the Second World War and integrate itself in it rather than developing new channels? But you're thinking that developing the new channels is all part of the emerging formula.
Yes. I don't think a formula makes it sound like it's a plan, like this is what people really want. As a currency strategist,
right,
I have a luxury of being able to look above the partisan and say, I know what you think you're doing, but here's what it really looks like. And I think that our children will be able to look back at this time and see that the Berlin Wall falls, end of Soviet Union, end of communism in Europe, and that Europe becomes more insular. And at the same time, Asia, China since the late 70s, opening up India's development, and that this is where the bulk of the world's population is, and this is where the dynamism of the world economy is, and exactly how we build this out is partly a combination, I'd say, of local nationalism, partly about U.S. ability to project its power, and of course, military is part of that power, but even if it wasn't for the U.S., that South China Sea, Southeast Asia is a dangerous neighborhood. We've got so many nuclear powers. I don't think that in the U.S. we're always sensitive to what a dangerous neighborhood that is. Pakistan and India, nuclear weapons. North
right.
Korea, nuclear weapons.
Right.
China, nuclear weapons. The Iranians want to get nuclear weapons. You know, the Japanese are just as assertive with what they want for their security. And so I think it's a dangerous neighborhood. And I think that the U.S. has to be a player in each of those little, where there's competition. The U.S. needs to have a voice.
You've been listening to a conversation with Mark Chandler of Brown Brothers Harriman. This is the concluding podcast in the Foreign Policy Association's 6-part series on U.S.-China relations. The music on this podcast was performed by the Norwich University Regimental Band, the oldest collegiate regimental band in the country. This is your host, Sarwar Kashmiri. Please let us know what you thought of this virtual roundtable of 6 podcasts by leaving your comments on www.fpa.org. That's www.fpa.org. Until next time, thank you for listening.